are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 10th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Chief Washington correspondent, The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, on his book, We've Got People. Also on the program today, caught in a lie. Donald Trump claims there's a secret plan for Mexico to fix immigration. Also on the program today, Senate tries a bipartisan effort to halt Saudi Arabian arms sales. John Dean will testify to the House Judiciary Committee. North Carolina fails to overturn the governor's veto of the latest forced pregnancy bill. Donald Trump ends fetal tissue research at the NIH, as well as federal funding. And a report, Google made $4.7 billion last year off of news producers. Lawsuits may follow. And as part of a broad health insurance program, young undocumented immigrants will be getting subsidized health care in California. And a massive Brazilian leak shows that the supposedly impartial prosecutor slash judge, as if that works, Moro, was in the bag in his pursuit of Lula. And finally, the White House friendship tree has died. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Another week of fun ahead of us, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you could start it off with us. And we look forward to your being here. I just want to mention this is it's pretty sad. I did not know this guy, but I read his work quite a bit on various outlets, Salon, The American Prospect. He wrote other places. I just particularly remember his pieces from there. And also on Twitter, Simon Malloy passed away. He apparently had an extended battle with colon cancer. He had been working at Media Matters for about 14 years. And he has a family with kids and whatnot. And so there's a GoFundMe to help support his family. And also a donation to the Colorectal Cancer Alliance. So we've placed that on the the blog, and on we'll put it in the podcast description. Sad, someone that young in particular, obviously with children, passes away, and appreciate the work that he did. Real shame. So check that out. Meanwhile, let's turn to something that is will raise your spirits just a little bit more instead. People are still apparently interested in Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon headed to Europe ostensibly to sort of expand the Breitbart empire. Right? Wasn't that his agenda?
Well, it wasn't Breitbart. It was his empire as a global fascist as a global fascist strategist.
But wasn't he going to do this as part
of Breitbart?
He's not
part of Breitbart anymore.
Oh, is he not?
He was kicked out of Breitbart.
Oh, that's right.
This
and
is
Breitbart,
it
all of that seems
to have faded. It's called the movement.
Right, okay. So he's got this movement, and he went over to Europe to see if he couldn't jumpstart fascism over there. He, having had jumpstarted it here, and it maybe not going necessarily the way that he wanted it to. Or maybe he knows that we got to go tit for tat, back and forth. Every now and then he rears his head and media just jumps at the opportunity to talk to him. I think maybe we are ending that era now. That is what is most interesting to me about this moment here from the Axios show. Jonathan Swan, coming off of his conversations with the boy prince, Jared Kushner, apparently interviews, are they in an elevator? I'm not quite sure what's going on here, but they seem to be, they're not in an elevator, some type of press conference. So here's Jonathan Swan asking Steve Bannon how his program to turn a Europe fascist is going.
I want to talk to you about something that you told the New York Times. You said you would offer populist parties across Europe the, quote, fundamental building blocks for winning, including expertise in polling, data analytics, messaging, and get-out-the-vote efforts, along with the development of media surrogates, campaign war rooms, rapid response.
Yep.
Quite a plan you had there. Have you executed it?
We got our lawyers involved, and with election laws in Europe, I'm not so sure that we can actually provide that.
How many campaign war rooms did you set up?
We had our overall war room, but we were told we couldn't do the war rooms either.
Sounds like you haven't done anything.
No,
pause it.
Wait,
pause it. This is such a wonderful shot. Steve Bannon, his gut hanging out, and we had an overall war room, but that one we had to establish in space because we weren't allowed to do it on European territory, I guess. And here he goes.
We set up a digital war
room.
Go
back
Gmail.
Just a little bit here because I love
we
the
had
fact
a Google Doc.
You know, the editor was like, dude, check out this cut. As soon as he says you haven't done anything, I'm going to go to him with his belly hanging out for the first time
totally.
In this interview. Go ahead.
You executed it.
We got our lawyers involved, and with election laws in Europe, I'm not so sure that we can actually provide that.
How many campaign war rooms did you set up?
We had our overall war room, but we were told we couldn't do the war rooms either.
Sounds like you haven't done anything.
No, that's absolutely not true. If you go back and talk to the individual parties, we've done tremendous...
Who should we talk to? What do you think Salvini would say?
I think Salvini said, hey, these guys are solid guys, and they've given us a lot of overall advice.
So we spoke to Salvini.
Yep.
Salvini said he's spoken to you twice in his life. Barely knows you.
Well, I mean, it's
but is that true with Salvini? He said he's only spoken to you twice ever.
I think maybe three or four times. We've talked to Salvini three or four times.
I think a cynic might say, okay, Steve Bannon, Trump purged him from American politics, cut him off at the legs, and now he's taking his show to a monastery. He's hanging out in the monastery trying to get crowds in Europe. I mean, is this just because you don't have relevance in American politics?
I think I have a lot of relevance.
It's brutal.
Yeah, the shots and the pacing are kind of reminiscent of The Office there.
That was
fascist David Brent.
You are in a monastery now. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah. That reminds me, actually, there was a... Harry Enfield did a mock documentary in 1990 called Sir Norbit Smith. And it is about an aging British actor. And for the British, it was basically light parody. For an American, it was more satirical. Because you don't know the specific references. And so things become a little bit broader. And there was a moment where they had an interview where he was on an interview program that was reminiscent of that. And there's a British tradition of this where the guy is saying to the actor, like, who's clearly been drinking and looks like Bannon in this. You look at you. You're a mess. I don't think so. Well, I can smell you from here. Well, that's too bad. And I've been having an affair with your wife, and she's a wonderful lover. Oh, good. And that was basically very reminiscent of that. But Steve Bannon, hopefully that's the last time we will ever cover anybody covering Steve Bannon, because I think that era has ended. It was a blip in our...
he was on just 2 weeks ago on CNBC tag teaming with Thomas Friedman about China policy. So if there's one thing Steve Bannon is good at, it's media exposure. And if there's one thing the elite media is good at, is exposing they have absolutely no values or sense of history.
Yes. But hopefully we're nearing the end.
Well, we'll see how he does when he gets into the Buckfast.
The what?
Oh, it's like this gross alcohol made by monks.
I see. Well, he may already be there. Folks, one of today's sponsors is Skillshare. Anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport4 is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design, video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You'll have no problem finding courses that will be useful to you both in your personal and professional life. I've been taking some cooking little classes, picking up tips everywhere I go, and I'm getting into like the data analysis stuff for work.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we'll see.
Data.
They have courses. Data. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses for computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. Jamie, you could learn, you could brush up on your Spanish. I've been...
See.
Like, there you go. It's already getting better. I'm also planning to get to the lucid dreaming thing. I had nightmares last night, but I'm going to check out that lucid dreaming. That's what I really need to do.
You absolutely should do that.
You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport4. We got a link, of course, in our podcast description and under YouTube. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. That's skl.sh/majorityreport4. Check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm. I had a coat of many colors, sold it off online. And now I duck my older brothers beneath the long leaf pine. Well, I did what I thought I was supposed to do. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program. Are you the Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept?
That's right.
The Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept and the author of many books, his most recent. is from Jesse Jackson to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the end of big money and the rise of a movement. We've got people. It just occurs to me that the book that you wrote on drugs has almost like that project's almost over.
Well, this is a nice sequel to that in some ways, but you're right, you know, and that book was magic in a way that it managed to completely transform the conversation without anybody actually having bought it.
Sometimes the cover can just do that.
Boom. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Best cover in the last 100 years in book literary history.
This, I was just telling you off air that I'm really enjoying this. I mean, it is because a lot of this, not all of it, but a significant amount of it was contemporaneous from when I basically entered into politics and began to, you know, sort of have some access to some of the players in this book and certainly people who were talking and stuff that I just had no idea. Was going on, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, it's super interesting and we'll go through it. Let's just start with We've Got People is, it's a specific quote, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. It's ripped off from the kind of climactic line in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's viral campaign ad. She said something like, you know, in her campaign against Joe Crowley, this is a contest about money versus people. They've got money, we've got people. And like so much of what she does, she's great at like distilling things down. And I heard that phrase, I'm like, we've got people, they've got money, we've got people. Like that basically, puts not too fine a point on the coverage that I've been doing of the Democratic Party and the resistance within it for the last like 12 years or so. I lifted three words of it for the title.
When you look at these 12 years that you did the coverage and you start the book during Jesse Jackson's campaign, his first one, I guess, was in 84, but, you know, 80-80 comes pretty close. And then I want to go back, but just to keep it just a little general, like, is this a story of, I mean, because it seems to me there's two sort of parallel tracks that are more or less aligned, but not completely aligned, of ideology within the party or with like sort of a disposition within the party. Do you know what I'm saying by that?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think by disposition, you kind of mean the fighting spirit.
Yes.
The willingness to take risks, to say what you really believe, to put it out before the American people and trust in their kind of judgment, versus the parallel generation of people like Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Chuck Schumer, who lived through the Reagan years, and internalized the idea that we live in this irredeemable conservative center-right country, and that the only way for Democrats to cling to some modicum of power is to pretend that they're somewhat conservative as well. And so it creates a different disposition. And it's been interesting going out on this book tour and talking to people who actually read the book, which is very flattering. And so many of them just say, why won't these Democrats fight? It's not even that they are pining for them to win even necessarily. They just want them to fight for something. And if you put up a fight and you lose, you know, at least you went for it. There's some dignity in that. But I think disposition is a good way of putting it.
I want to circle back, but let's have part of this conversation now. I mean, because, you know, during the Netroots years, right, when you basically started reporting mm-hmm. and more or less when I entered into, doing whatever it is I do here, and part of it was because it was during the Bush years, right? And mm-hmm. it sort of flattened out any differences amongst Democrats from an ideological perspective, right? Like I mean, I just remember like this sort of this like dawning on me, like, oh my God, when I was talking with Jonathan Alter in a green room at MSNBC, and he's saying like, I don't understand why people are being so chaste about Social Security. And I was like, what? You wrote an yeah. autobiography. You wrote a biography about FDR. Are you kidding me? Like, I had no idea that you were that open to cutting, you know? But we didn't talk much about ideological differences, you know, right. 15 years ago, 12 years ago. It was, you know, you'd say good Democrat, bad Democrat. You would say fighting Democrat, non-fighting Democrat. Like, how much of that disposition is it? And then I want to go back to the Reagan years. But how much of that disposition is just simply disposition? I'm cowed, and I just, you know, and now I have a tin ear. I learned some lessons, you know, as a newbie, and those lessons have stuck. Versus ideologically, I'm actually sort of this way, and I use the disposition as a way of not having to deal with that.
Yeah, I think it's entirely related to ideology, and the way that you can kind of prove that in a way is to take a look at somebody like Rahm Emanuel. You know, he's known as a fighting Democrat. I think you might have been in that off the record private blogger meeting in, I think, 2005 with Bill Clinton, where he said, I don't understand why you bloggers are so tough on Rahm. He's really a fighter. But who he was a fighter against was the left.
Right.
So they do know how to fight. Democratic Party knows, to this day, knows how to fight. Look at the ECCC and the lengths that it's willing to go to crush insurgent primary challenges before they've even been launched. And so when the opportunity to go after the left surfaces, then all of a sudden their disposition changes and they do become these fighting liberals. And so that leads me to conclude that the disposition is really just a piece of ideology that they do know how to fight, but they're just accustomed to not fighting for the left, but rather against the left.
Right. But I don't know if that still fully answers my question as much as like, they're afraid to fight the right because your argument is, during the Reagan years, and it's interesting to peg it at the Reagan years, because I think a lot of times, you know, like 10 or 15 years ago, we would have pegged it to McGovern, maybe even more recently, right? Like, this was a lesson that people are living out from McGovern era. And that's why we called it hippie punching instead of, like, you know, punching to the left. It was hippie punching at that time. 10, 15 years ago, we would refer to that, you know, beating up on the left. Ostensibly, like, the way that they did it. But why is it the Reagan era? I mean, I remember going into college and having my government professor, the government professors address us on day one saying, there's been a realignment. It was 1984. It was the second election. There's been a realignment in this country. And there's been a monumental shift in the political identification of the American public. Was that basically what scarred a lot of these people?
Yes, and I think it's totally fair to link McGovern to that. Like, that was a precipitating event, and certainly you still hear them today, like, talk about McGovern. Like literally to this day, they will mention, you know, if we do X, it's just going to be McGovern all over again. But Mondale lost, you know, extraordinarily badly as well. And the reason I focus more on the Reagan era is because not just, you know, it wasn't just that McGovern lost, but you still had a kind of Rockefellerian kind of Republican Party at that time. So they everything they stood for wasn't being, you know, thoroughly rejected. Whereas in the 1980s, this was the rise of the new right. You know, this like insurgent Republican class comes in the 1978 midterms. That's when Newt Gingrich is first elected, then followed by Ronald Reagan, who's a new kind of Republican. And at the same time, Democrats are rethinking, you know, what their posture is toward their own coalition and toward particularly big money and corporate money. And so it's in that era that they kind of reinvent themselves as this, what becomes this Clintonian party. So that's why I thought it was more interesting to focus on the 80s. And also because, yes, like Pelosi and Hoyer, these others, they did live through McGovern, but they were more in it when Reagan was stomping them. You know, they were, you know, Hoyer was, I think, elected in 1981 in a special election. Pelosi was already a major fundraiser. Chuck Schumer, I think, was elected to the House in 1980. Dick Durbin in 1982. Barney Frank in 80. So these people are all kind of coming into their own and their professional prime at that time where they're watching everything change underneath them.
And I think it was like Tony Coelho. Yeah. I can't remember.
Coelho. He gets he becomes DCCC chair after the 1980 election on the very explicit argument that the problem Democrats had wasn't political or ideological. Well, it wasn't ideological. It wasn't structural. It was just that they got outgunned by Republicans who figured out how to raise more money, and they figured out how to pump that money into negative campaigning and 30-second ads and dirty tricks. And so what Democrats needed to do, he argued, was develop what he called a PAC strategy, which just means fundraising today, and go to corporate America, get a ton of money, hire consultants like Republicans did, and run the same types of, you know, dirty tricks campaigns with 30-second negative ads, and just match them dollar for dollar, and just kind of keep filling keep putting your fingers in the dike that way.
And that was almost like the seed that ended up creating the Democratic Leadership Council and mm-hmm. this whole wing.
Totally.
So now, how conscious do you think?
Remember, they won in 82, the huge midterm wave after Reagan. So they're like, oh, this is it. We got it.
We figured it out.
We figured this out.
How much awareness was there and how much debate was there around that time as to the implications of getting Democratic money that way? Right. Like, cause it could be an awareness of like, I want to get us in bed with corporate America, or it could be like, oh, I'm just going to go, you know, and hang out with corporate America, but mm-hmm. I won't get in bed with them. I'm just going to take their money.
Right.
But inevitably what happens is one thing leads to another. You take their money and then you have a couple of drinks and then one thing leads to another. And then you're in bed with them
Yeah, and the argument they made was along those lines. Coelho said, look, yes, we lost the House. I mean, we lost the Senate. We lost the White House, but we still control the House. And they thought they had basically permanent control of it because of the structure of and the popularity of a lot of these longtime Democrats. And so their argument was, we're not compromising ourselves here. We're not giving anything to corporate America. But we control the House of Representatives, and so they need to pay up. Like, that's how this new system works. Like, if they want their legislation considered, you know, if they want to meet with us, if they want to be part of the tax reform that we're going to do, and all, you know, all the other work that we're going to do with the Republican Senate and the Reagan administration, then they need to ante up. And that's how they sold it as not being corrupting. It's just exploiting the power that you already have to force a weaker entity to pony up. But there was, what I gathered in my reporting, there was a lot of pushback internally. But the people who were doing the pushback didn't have an alternative idea,
right,
or they didn't have the power to implement an alternative idea.
What does Coelho say today about that?
He says, he has this great quote where he says, we didn't necessarily sell out. It was more that we were bought in, was his phrase. And it's actually that as he kind of parses it, it's an interesting way of thinking about it.
That's a Mort Saul line.
Right. He's saying that, like, we wouldn't take a pile of cash and do something for it, but all of our strategic legislative thinking was constrained and guided by the PAC strategy that we were taking. That you're doing a housing bill, and you know this particular company or industry doesn't really like it going in this direction, and then you don't even need to talk to them. you just kind of don't go in that direction. You pursue the path of least corporate resistance wherever you can, and so that ends up just corrupting the process, but without a direct quid pro quo, you know, cash for a particular line of legislation.
Did he express regret? I mean, I only ask, I'm only focusing on something this is sort of small, because I think that dynamic that you've just described is really the hinge that all of this turns on.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
He's a lobbyist now. he and a lot of the others feel, and it's not an obvious question, but so he and the others feel like there was nothing else that they could do.
Right.
They feel like they were facing the fascists, like they were at the gates, they're inside the gates, and the New Deal coalition had broken apart, and that, you know, without a new coalition to put together, this was their only choice, and that they did this, and they made some, you know, difficult compromises to save the republic from complete collapse. Although, there is not much
regret.
Now, people who say that people will acknowledge that people that I talked to from that era, they'll acknowledge, yes, it was a lot more corrupting, or it was as corrupting as people predicted that it would be, and more corrupting than its defenders said it would be. But many of them will still say, but there wasn't necessarily another option.
Now, I the only other option would be to get thrashed and then come back from the ashes, reconfigured in a different way, right? I mean, because that would have been...
Right, and then they got thrashed anyway.
Right. All right, well then, all right, so go forward to Jesse Jackson, because, I mean, one can only imagine, like, if the internet had existed in 1986, mm-hmm. right? Like, our history might be very, very different in a myriad of ways.
Right.
But go ahead. I mean, just tell us what happens with Jesse Jackson there.
And to that point, Jerry Brown, remember, in 1992, ran kind of an insurgent campaign against Clinton, and he used to give his 800 number.
Yeah.
He wouldn't take more than $100 from anybody. And
there was a problem during a debate, if I remember correctly, too, right? Like, they tried to get him, like, you can't say your 800 number. He goes, I can't say my 800 number, Jerry Brown, you know, whatever it was. I can't remember what it was. But he's, and they were like, well, you can't do that. I just did it, you know? So
I like the way that, you know, Bernie said, go to BernieSanders.com. It was, you know, very reminiscent of that. But Jesse didn't have that. And to your point, so Jesse Jackson, and I would have called the book, From Harold Washington to AOC, if more people had heard of Harold Washington.
Yes, actually.
He was the...
Yeah, tell that story.
Yeah, he was the mayor.
From mayor of Chicago.
Yeah, he runs as an insurgent. He's a member of Congress. He had the backing of Democratic Socialists of America, the young lords, like a ton of radical and insurgent elements of Chicago politics. They run to take on the machine, you know, with Jesse Jackson as his, like, lead campaigner. And I interviewed Jackson about this, and he said that he got wind that Ted Kennedy and Walter Mondale were going to come in and endorse Daley, and Jackson begged them. He said, "Just stay out. Like, you have no idea the vibrancy of this movement that we're running. Like, we don't need your endorsement, but just don't come in and bring the two most well-known Democrats in the country and endorse our opponent." And Kennedy said, "Look, we're old family friends. We don't have a choice. We've got to do it." And Jackson said he thought to himself, "This needs to change." Like, his quote was something like, "This liberalism is not liberating." And so he started seeing himself and seeing that movement in direct conflict with the party establishment, even the kind of liberal heavyweights of the party. They wind up winning the primary, and then the entire Chicago Democratic machine flips and literally campaigns for the Republican in the general election. And Washington manages to win the general election, but only by like 4 points in a city that's what, 92% Democratic. And then they spend the next several years going to war with the machine that still controlled the council for a little while. But so out of that campaign, Jackson and other Black leaders around the country get together and say, you know, we need to do the same thing at the presidential level, because there's just no other way that we're going to get people to pay attention, to our interests. And so he runs a very late campaign in 1984 that does surprisingly well, even though he got in, you know, I think after some of the caucuses had already started. And so then he runs in 88 as a serious contender, you know, echoes of Bernie starting as a protest candidate and then getting serious. And more than 35 primaries and caucuses into the race, he dishes this stunning upset out to Dukakis and Dick Gephardt in Michigan. And all of a sudden, like, Dick Gephardt drops out and it's just Jackson and Dukakis in basically a delegate tie. And the Democratic establishment in Washington has a complete and utter meltdown at the prospect that Jesse Jackson might actually become the Democratic nominee at this point.
And then what happens?
The whole fury of the party comes down on him, and they get very explicit that the country's not ready to elect a Black man. A, B, he's too liberal, and C, it's not only would he lose the presidential election, but it would basically be the end of the Democratic Party. You know, if he's the nominee, the phrases coming out of Washington were just absolutely apocalyptic. And he was polling ahead, coming out of Michigan. He's now surging into Wisconsin and polling significantly ahead. And if he wins Wisconsin, you know, then he's on a roll with momentum heading into the convention. And despite the big polling lead, he winds up losing pretty badly in Wisconsin. One of the first examples of pollsters, you know, telling people that they're going to vote for the Black candidate and then not doing so when they get into the polling place. And so from there he fades, but for about a week and a half, the country was, facing the real possibility that Jackson would win the nomination. And he was doing it on the back of this argument that kind of neoliberalism was inflicting economic violence on the working classes, white, Black, and brown. And that the only way to fight back was to unite, farmers who are suffering from a farm crisis and factory workers and everybody else against the growing power of capital and Ronald Reagan.
So, all right. So I just want to sort of like disaggregate a couple of things, because there's a sort of an analogous two-track type of fight that's going on here. That's sort of similar to the one that we talked about, you know, at the top of this interview, which is, you know, in the case of Washington, and on some level in the case of Jesse Jackson, but it gets a little bit muddled, because, you know, the idea that I think there were probably people who, and I'm not being an apologist for this, but I think there were people who probably sincerely felt like the country is not ready to elect a Black man to be president in 1988, right. And we've got to get rid of, I remember quite distinctly this election. We've got to get rid of Reagan, even though it's George Herbert Walker Bush who's running. Right. It's still the Reagan era. People perceived it that way. And there was this sort of like immediacy. But there's two things that are going
and
on
there
here.
Go ahead.
Well, in the Washington case makes it a little bit more explicit. Like, how much of that was, this guy's not part of our network, and so therefore we don't like him, versus this guy's so, you know, his politics. Because this also, that the Harold Washington thing reminds me a little bit of Martha Coakley when she ran for Senate in Massachusetts. Now, she came from the West, and, you know, Massachusetts, there is a very much of an old boy network in Massachusetts politics. And my understanding is that they basically just said, we're not going to give her support in the general election against Scott Brown. Like, we're just, we're walking away. And and that I don't think was a question of as much as like as much as politics, because I don't think her politics were particularly, you know, ideologically different from these these establishment politicians in Massachusetts.
Right.
But it's just like, hey, wait a second, we're not going to be the ones to get the largesse. We're not going to get the jobs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We're not going to have the ability to call people and say, hey, I want that low license plate number, whatever it is. Like, that's
right.
Like, how much of it is just a machine that is distinct from, you know, ideology, and how much of it is ideology when you see this dynamic at play?
So he had all three things going for him or going against him, depending on how you see it. You know, part of it's race, deeply racist city. All American cities are racist. Chicago's especially so. Particularly in that era. Ideologically, like he had the support of the DSA because they recognized that he kind of aligned with a lot of their politics, and he was talking about. He ran on firing the police chief. He ran against police brutality, and he ran against the kind of economic interests that ran the city. And so there definitely was an ideological gap between him and the machine. And then third, he had the thing that you talked about. He wasn't one of them. Like, he was. Yeah, in a city that is run on spoils, like, there were going to be no spoils to hand out. And it's one of the most old school machines out there. You know,
right?
You know, how you vote determines whether or not you get your trash picked up. And so that was a huge part of it too. But it wasn't just that. Like, with Martha Coakley, I think you're right. It's more like it's basically just that. The rest is nihilism.
Right.
They don't really care. But in this case,
it was all of it. And there's also that parallel, we should also say, and I'm jumping ahead again, but you wrote a piece about, the 2018 primaries that talked about the DCCC coming in and basically, you know, being at odds with local folk running for office or trying to recruit candidates. And, you know, I combined the reporting you did there with I think it was Theta Scotchwell and Lena Putnam, I think. I'm getting her name wrong, I think. And there was one other person who did similar research. And the stories were similar. You know, some of it involved ideology, but some of it was just like, hey, we're the experts and we come from, Washington.
Yeah.
We know what we're talking about. And you're going to do what we say, because also this is our business. Like, this is how, we throw money to certain consultants. And then when I move on to my next job, they get me my next job, or they help me out, or they're social friends. I mean, people experience this in their real lives all the time. It's just that the stakes are a little bit less public-y.
Yeah. And the best example of that would probably be Laura Moser in that Texas primary, because she was not an insurgent leftist candidate. You know, she was part of the resistance. She launched this Daily Action app that let people make, a single text or a single phone call a day to resist Trump. She was pro Pelosi. She was just a fairly, liberal Democrat, but her husband worked for Revolution Messaging, the consulting firm that kind of worked on the Bernie Sanders campaign, which meant that it was the black sheep of the Democratic consulting world. And when they attacked her publicly, this made big news. It was so strange that the DCCC was attacking a Democrat publicly. One of their most significant takedown points of her was that she had used her husband's consulting firm for some work, which was just a hilarious charge for the DCCC to make, because the executive director of the DCCC's wife was at the time getting a bunch of contracts from the DCCC, and like this is like that's how the DCCC
right
does it. That's not an anomaly. That's just what you do. And the fact that they highlighted that to me was a tell that it was about the consultants. That, like you said, she was not using one of us. This is a threat to the, you know, if Revolution doesn't just do a Bernie Sanders campaign, but starts doing winning House campaigns, then that's a threat to the whole DCCC consulting nexus.
That's an important, I think, a thing for people to keep in mind that I think we tend as people who, you know, follow politics and are engaged because of ideological reasons, presume that everything is that based on ideology, when sometimes it's just based on, I just want my friends to be able to get paid because that mm-hmm. means that I get paid at one point. And that is, that's, I think, an important thing to understand, at least in terms of when you're looking at this stuff. And it also, like, you know, which is gets back again to that sort of central hinge of your reporting here in this book, is that where you get your resources from ends up being a huge part of every decision that you're able to make at any given point. And I don't want to skip too much over the Dean era, but in many respects, he was the one, you know, Jerry Brown tried it, but Dean in the internet age, it seems to me, mm-hmm. Built the framework for, and I'm not saying he himself, but the people on the campaign right. built a framework for the small donors. And so many of the people that influence our politics today in some way, particularly on the left and the more populist mm-hmm. arguments, came out of that campaign.
Right, right. And he fits with what you were talking about, less ideological and
yes.
just a fighting spirit. Like he himself wasn't terribly progressive. He appeared that way because he was anti-war. He's from Vermont. He was a doctor who was into universal health care. And so you take those things together and you're like, this guy's probably progressive. We've since learned that that's not necessarily the case, but he was one of the few people who was willing to go right at Bush when Bush was at the height of his war popularity. And so that willingness to fight is what gathered so many people around him. And I think, yeah, that's a big difference between his campaign and Jackson's. And, you know, Jackson didn't have the ability to translate all of the energy that exploded around him into small dollars that could then be invested in, you know, in TV ads and building the infrastructure of a national campaign. Whereas Dean did have that. And so it took him from a, you know, huge long shot of a candidate to, you know, the front runner and presumed nominee for a while.
And there was,
until Democrats decided he wasn't electable, but that's another story.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story too. I mean, insofar as the, you know, the there was intense dislike of Dean on the campaign bus, as it were. Like the press didn't like him. There was. That was where sort of, and again, like, you know, this point can't be made enough. Dean is a perfect example of this. Dean was rather conservative, at least, you know, from a financial standpoint, and mm-hmm. As governor of Vermont. And
yeah.
the dislike for him was in many respects, like the fact that his campaign was the birth of, I think, like the amateur journalists and the, you know, like the activist mm-hmm. journalists that came with the blogs that the press really hated at that time. I mean, really,
yeah.
With a white hot passion.
Right. It's hard to quite appreciate how much they hated bloggers at that time. I mean, you can kind of sense some of it just in the rhetoric around the, you know, pajamas and sitting in their mom's basement eating Cheetos. But yeah, they felt like, and also, you know, it was all bound up in the, they felt the collapse of the print journalism industry. And the most obvious and easiest people to blame would be the bloggers, you know, rather than, you know, Craigslist and all the other, you know, threats to the print, to the print industry. They saw these people as the ones that were driving them out of business. And it's just a couple of punk kids. I had no idea what they were doing as far as the press was concerned.
And it wasn't even just that from a business standpoint, because I don't even think they were aware of what was happening from a business standpoint. It was a status thing. Like you and right. I, Marcos Melitzis, but forget Marcos Melitzis. You, I'm trying to think of what Nate Silver's, handle was, like Paco something or something.
Right.
On you don't have the same authority to talk about politics as I do, and the idea that right. People are reading Atrios, right. Some guy whose name we don't even know. And, are equating, Atrios with me, who works for the New York Times, is disgusting. Like, I mean, it was literally right. that type of like personal, to the point where people thought that Atrios was, Joe Klein, I think it was, because they wanted to imagine like, oh, there's no way just some boob is writing with this level of insight. Right. And, so that's what happens going forward from there. And that's where everything starts to take off, right? Like the blogs that are empowered by Dean was empowered by the blogs in many respects. And those people mm-hmm. start to infiltrate different offices. And the biggest, I think, sort of like dynamic change from a politician because of that seems to me you write about is Harry Reid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had always gotten that sense. And so it was nice to be able to talk to him about that and kind of walk him through it without prompting him. And he said that, yeah, that he went to the first yearly Coast conference. And he said, I didn't quite know what this whole thing was about, but I could tell that it was going to be big, that there was energy around it. It was something new and important. And I wanted to be on the front end of it rather than, the middle or the end of it. And then he ends up, hiring people out of that, out of the blogosphere into his office. And they start using the office of the majority leader eventually as in a weaponized way that the left has always said, political power should be wielded. A bunch of those folks are now on the Bernie Sanders campaign, and Reid very much shifted left on a whole host of issues, through his interactions with these bloggers, turned staffers.
And I don't think people understood, like, he was. He was the guy who, I think, to the extent that any Democrat takes responsibility for protecting Social Security during the Obama mm-hmm. years, because I think a lot of the credit, frankly, goes to the Freedom Caucus because they just they could not make a deal, even though, they could not take yes for an answer. But to the extent that anybody right. does, Harry Reid not only changed, and you write about in terms of marriage equality ultimately, and don't ask, don't mm-hmm. tell repeal, which people forget was repealed less than 10 years ago, I guess now.
Right.
He was also adamant about Social Security, and there was a conflict with him and Joe Biden. Tell us about that one.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that was, and that goes to Biden's, professed, calling card. He talks about how he can work with Republicans. There was a particular moment after the 2012 election where all of the Bush tax cuts were expiring because they had used reconciliation, which means your legislation can only be in place for 10 years. That's the that's what you have to give to get the 50 vote threshold. And so if Democrats did nothing, then all of the Bush tax cuts would expire. And so Reid was driving a pretty hard bargain with McConnell. And as he told me in a later interview, that's because he actually intended to go over the cliff and let the tax rates go back up. Because then his argument was, now we're talking about tax cuts. Because right. The taxes have gone all back to their original spot. Now, okay, you want some tax cuts? Let's talk tax cuts. Let's do a middle class tax cut, and make it a huge middle class tax cut, trillions of dollars. I'm good with that. And McConnell would have to be calling for a huge tax cut for the rich. And Reid felt like, especially with Obama's 2012 reelection, that they were in a good spot to argue that. And at the last minute, he gets yanked out of it by the White House, and they send in Joe Biden. And Joe Biden, in like a day or two, cuts a far worse deal than McConnell had even already agreed to. Like, McConnell had already agreed that taxes on everybody over 250, making 250 a year, would go back up. And they were sorting out the details from there, and as we know, Reid was going to let him go over and probably wouldn't even have given him that much. But Biden comes in and basically wipes out the estate tax and says that everybody making 400 and above, so everybody between 250 and 400 gets saved by
Biden. It's basically like Reid was like, I'm going to sell you this car for $25,000. And Biden comes in and says, I'll take care of this. I'm going to sell you this car for $22,000.
Yeah,
I made
right.
a deal. And McConnell had already said, well, I'll take the car for $25,000, but I also want the car stereo. Yeah. And Biden comes in and goes, I'm going to give you the car stereo, and I'm going to give you the car for $22,000.
And so McConnell just reaches onto the desk and takes his $3,000 back.
Exactly.
He says, thank you. He says, okay.
Why did Biden do that?
So that's a good question. Part of it is he's not very good at his job, I don't think. He's very lazy. Like, that's a big knock on him. Another is that he spends a lot of time with rich people. And so to him, like, maybe increasing taxes on people on the $251,000 that you make on a year seemed onerous. He just loves striking deals with McConnell and Republicans. And he also wasn't too concerned about doing a lot legislatively. So Reid wanted one reason Reid wanted to bring in that extra revenue is that they're in an era of PAYGO, where all of the spending, had to be offset somewhere with some sort of revenue increase or cut elsewhere. And so, letting the Bush tax cuts expire gives you a ton of revenue that you can apply to new spending programs. And Reid wanted to do that. Biden and the White House didn't seem, they were very pessimistic about their ability to get anything done, get anything through Congress. So what good is the revenue anyway? I asked Reid that exact question. He said, you'd have to ask Joe.
All right. Well, so that takes us up. Let's briefly, we're a little bit, and I appreciate your hanging with me here. So we go through this, and really in many respects, Sanders starts his campaign as an issue campaign. He does much better than he thought that he would, it seems to me. And it seems like somewhere around January of 2017 or 2018 or 16, excuse me, 16, he realizes, like, I could win this, but it's basically too late in many respects.
Right.
For him to, he needed to go back in time and have had laid some groundwork because winning a campaign is extremely difficult. But what comes out of this is a huge mass of energy that gets dispersed into different organizations and different techniques of raising money. And it shows that someone can go and raise money without having to have corporate mm-hmm. interests. And let's just tell us a story about the Justice Dems, which came out of, which is like a third generation or second generation sort of Sanders people. And what decision they made that ultimately proved to be the right one.
Yeah, and what was cool about this crew is that a normal campaign wouldn't have hired really any of them for the most part. But the Sanders campaign and Becky Bond, who's one of them, talked to me about this, said that, you know, they had a real hard time hiring professional campaigners and consultants because anybody who worked for the Sanders campaign was going to be blacklisted from a Clinton-dominated party going forward. Jeff Weaver came out of, he had gone to run a comic book shop, retired from politics, and came back to run the campaign. And then this crew that gets into what they end up calling distributed organizing, which is basically taking the Sanders volunteer army and putting them to work doing, door knocking, text messaging, house parties, and, turning all that energy into voter contacts. That team is people like Becky Bond and Zach Exley, both Zach in particular, was influential in the Dean campaign. So like you said, like a lot of the very same people who were involved in the beginning are still doing a lot of this today. Then you had Corbin Trent, who was a food truck operator in Tennessee. And you had Shroy Chakrabarty, who left Silicon Valley. He was an engineer at Stripe, payment processor. He becomes like an engineer for this team. And then you had movement people like Zach Malice and Claire Sandberg, who like come out of Occupy, anti-globalization movement, not the kind of up the typical like work for a campaign, work for a state legislative campaign, then a congressional campaign, then a Senate campaign, then a presidential. And so because of that, they all thought very differently about how to organize a campaign. And they really had only figured it out, like you said, by January. Something like 85% to 90% of the voter contacts that their operation made, and they made millions, tens of millions, came after January. So it's kind of too late for it to work. But in 2016, then as the campaign is winding down, they go out and they form this new group that they call Brand New Congress, where they're trying to elect 435 new members. And they go to Cenk Uygur and they say, hey, you think TYT would want to, the TYT viewers would want to support something like this? And he's like, this idea that you're going to run Bernie style candidates in Republican primaries is nice, but it's crazy because yes, the economic populism works with Republican voters, but they'd have to be anti-choice. They'd have to be anti-gay. Like we're not supporting candidates like that. That's not going to work. That's crazy. He's like, now the Democrats, all right, that could work. And so they say, well, what if we split it up? And so they carved the Democrats out and called them Justice Democrats. And Cenk said, okay, that we can get behind. And so he promoted them heavily on TYT and TYT.
Kyle Kalinske as well got involved in that as well.
Yeah. Huge. And they pumped more than $2 million, to get them off the ground. And then their idea that they were going to run these candidates in every district, didn't pan out. They wound up with several dozen. And then those several dozen, most of them were struggling. And so they pivoted at the end, said, let's pick one and go all in. And they picked Ocasio-Cortez. And then she, remained loyal to a lot of the the idea. And so, her victory speech that night, she talked about Ayanna Pressley and Cori Bush. And so they ended up winning Ayanna Pressley. Cori toward Bush. They did not. And so they going for 435, I guess they wound up with a couple. They had also gotten in behind people like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar in blue districts. But yeah, so this was without the Sanders campaign, you absolutely do not get a brand new Congress or Justice Democrats, and you don't get Ocasio-Cortez, who of course herself was
In many respects, that ends up being a very smart decision, right? I mean, to get her in ends up having, you know, that's a one to pound for pound. That ends up being
an exponential win there. Yeah.
So, okay. So ultimately, where do you anticipate things going right now? I mean, because the idea is, and I know that you've described this as aspirational, the end of big money. And I heard you talk at a book talk, and if anybody has the opportunity to go see it, it's a don't miss book talk, I should say. But where does that lead now? Because we've got Joe Biden does not represent that, right? And we have many of the candidates who are struggling, who started off like, I'm not going to take any.
Maybe he is the end of big money. I mean, think about it. Imagine you're the donor class, and you've already lost control of the Trump wing of the Republican Party, and you're clinging to your relevance in the Democratic Party, and the man that you're putting out onto the field of battle in this climactic final clash between the donor class and regular activists, your horse is Joe Biden. There's something symbolic in that. Like it's representative of the weak position that the donor class finds itself in. That this is who they're going to ride into the final battle. But like you said, like if voters, Democratic voters, decide that he's the electable one and that he's the smart choice to beat Trump, then it will be less the big money and more that punditry that voters engage in that will put him over the top. I think the only way that he's stopped is if voters decide that actually he's not electable, that he's a lousy campaigner, that he can't take a political punch, and that Trump would actually manhandle him in the general election. If voters decide that, then I think they start looking at some other options.
How much are, and we're sort of pivoting off of the book a little bit here, but how much are the campaigns there was obviously a push the past week or two. It's hard to know which of these campaigns are out there sort of like actively making life miserable for Joe Biden. But I got to imagine that, you know, last week I think was, the worst week that Joe Biden has had politically since he basically was picked by Barack Obama to be his running mate. It was where he, you know, had to reverse a position that he'd held for 40 years after 2 days of criticism say like, well, it was because of the Republican, it was a pretty lame cover story.
And actually a piece of the book rocked him back a little bit too. I pulled up a few quotes from him in the 70s, talking about, I'm not responsible for what my ancestors did 300 years ago. It's not the white man's problem to, he shouldn't have to give anything up, because of, what happened so long in the past. And then he said that, the two-party system is clearly going to be good for the Negro in the South.
Right.
This is after the Southern strategy. Like Nixon was already employing the Southern, the second party's strategy was to be more racist than the current party. That was a dubious claim to make at the time and has not been borne out at all. And so then, that kind of started him off, and then he followed up with this Hyde Amendment face plant which if you're the electable guy, you've got to show that you're good at getting elected.
Well, that is like the meta story, right? Because with him, it's all the meta story. And so every time he backs off a position, it shows weakness. Like, there hasn't been another candidate, as far as I know, that has had to back off a position yet, or at least so publicly anyways. And he had to do that because it suggested that he had some weakness. And when that starts to come out, it becomes self-perpetuating, I think.
Mm-hmm. And if he loses, let's say he loses in Iowa, that is worse for him than it is for anybody else.
Right.
Because, like you said, like, his whole thing is that he's a winner. And he should win the nomination because he's a winner and he will beat Trump. But if you don't win in Iowa and you don't have anything else, then it starts to fall in on itself.
You at the book talk, you had an interesting assessment of Warren and Sanders, in how you've sort of, you know, come around a little bit on Sanders, and people should understand that Elizabeth Warren, for people our generation — I'm older than you, but our generation in terms of like sort of like engagement in politics, you know, at least professionally, Elizabeth Warren came out of nowhere. And definitely not only like fought off Republicans, but also fought off Democrats as well, who were hesitant to allow her to have so much authority, which in many respects she sort of just like finagled in creating the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Just give me your sense of how your assessment of both those candidates and senators has evolved.
Yeah, and the irony is that the centrist Twitter crowd calls me a Bernie bro relentlessly, which is ironic given what you said, in that our generation, you know, we watched, we wanted someone to be, you know, to have that fighting spirit and to recognize that one of the problems with Democrats is that they weren't fighting hard enough for what they believed in, and so she comes in, and you know, her famous quote to the Huffington Post about the CFPB, she was like, you know, asked about compromising a particular element of it, and she said, "My first choice is a strong, independent CFPB, and my second choice is for the Senate floor to be covered in blood and teeth." And that was her attitude. That was her approach. And this was, you know, she's talking on the record here. This is not her aide giving a background quote. And every time that they would try to weaken the CFPB, you know, she would push back, and there'd be public outrage over it, and they would back off the attempts to neuter it. And the fact that it got through at all is remarkable. The fact that it got through with a single, you know, independent director and funding that can't be cut off by Congress is truly remarkable. And so we saw her doing that sort of thing, going after Tim Geithner in public, calling out, you know, Democrats and Republicans, and at the same time didn't see Sanders involved in much in the like post-2009 Obama era fights. He ironically, the thing he got pounded the most for in the 2016 primary is one time suggesting that somebody should primary Obama, out of frustration over Obama's kind of deficit hawkishness in the 2011 period. But, you know, it wasn't like he was an Elizabeth Warren who was constantly pushing him. So he got the worst of all worlds. Like, he wasn't really in it, but then he also got, you know, punished badly for it in the primary because Obama remained so popular. You know, to Bernie's credit, he got some significant money for community health centers in the Affordable Care Act. He got an audit the Fed bill through with Ron Paul. But beyond that, he was kind of like a non-factor, and he didn't use his position either to leverage media attention to progressive fights. He didn't organize progressives in the Senate to form a block to try to leverage. Like one of the most important fights during that time was blocking Larry Summers from being Fed chair.
Yep.
Like God knows what calamity the world was saved from by Jeff Merkley and Elizabeth Warren, you know, organizing progressive resistance to him and forcing Obama to drop him. And so for people like me, we watched Elizabeth Warren doing all this. And then we see Sanders' presidential campaign taking off. And we're like, where is this coming from? And so it did take me a while to recognize that kind of in spite of what Sanders had done before, and also partly because of his consistency in what he'd been saying for so long and the disengagement that I didn't like was a disengagement that also gave him an authenticity because he wasn't part of the system. And so it took me a while to come around to the idea that a real movement had formed around him and that he himself was beginning to recognize that, and that he stopped seeing himself as a gadfly and saw himself more as an actual political actor who was now on the world stage and had a chance to actually succeed in making some transformative change. And so I think it's been hard for a lot of people of my generation to make that turn and to see the new Sanders compared to the old one.
Right. I mean, it really, in many respects, was like that, you know, where he realized in, you know, January of 2016, like, oh my gosh, he entered in as doing an issue campaign. My understanding is he got in when he got in because he wanted to make sure that Warren wasn't going to run. And
right. he really pushed her hard to run, and she didn't do it.
She didn't do it in that cycle.
Right.
And so he jumped in to talk about wealth inequality and then realized that this really could resonate.
Yeah. And it also helps explain why Warren ultimately didn't endorse him, because she, like Sanders, they both thought that he was in there to raise the issues. He was in there to raise the issues. And so if you're in there to raise the issues,
They both thought that he was there exclusively to raise the issues, not
right,
to win.
Right.
And
right,
she
right.
wanted to be able to maintain, the power there.
Right. Right. Because her whole game was that she talked to Hillary twice privately about this, saying like, you know, I'm going to go to war with you over your personnel choices. Like if you try to stack your cabinet with Wall Street types, then I'm going to do everything I can, you know, in the Senate to block them. But I also want to be constructive, and I'll give you names of people who I think would be good regulators. And so, well, we can do this one of two ways. And so
right.
she was trying to keep some channel open between her and Hillary. I think in hindsight, Hillary should have told her, go ahead, endorse Bernie, because then when she ultimately beat Bernie, you know, to have Warren on stage endorsing her after having endorsing Bernie, you know, would have had more credibility to it.
Well, we could draw up whatever. A long list right. of woulda, shouldas when it comes to Clinton's campaign. Just, I think, frankly, taking Warren as her running mate would have been a smart move. My understanding is that Warren was interested in that as well. But Ryan Grimm, it's fascinating. There's so much to be learned. And the thing that I love about this is that, you know, and I would imagine even to some extent it would have even more value to listeners, is to be able to compare what I perceived was happening during throughout this era, in, you know, as recently as months ago almost, versus, you know, what deep reporting tells me was happening is very important so that people can have like a really clear-eyed assessment of what's going on and what are the forces here. This stuff is it's really fascinating, and the reporting is impeccable, and I appreciate you coming on and telling us about it.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Thank you.
All right, we're going to put a link up at majority.fm. The book is We've Got People, Ryan Grimm. Thanks again, Ryan. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
See you.
Check it out, folks. Honestly, really and I haven't gotten through all of it. It's a long book, but really just really well reported and just sort of fascinating to fill in large gaps that we have in our understanding of history that we have lived through. Because even when you read these reports contemporaneously, there's so much that comes at you to be able to sort of basically, you know, have a compilation of all this reporting and see it deeply reported with the value of 2020 hindsight and going back and asking more questions that were left open during the contemporaneous reporting. It really is interesting and, you know, important to understand as we go forward. I've had people who ask me, I mean, this is not directly related to this, but we did touch on it. What's the best way to argue against Biden to people? And the best way is, I don't think he can win. Like, he could win, but I don't think he could win. I mean, I would say risky choice.
Are you making an electability argument?
Well, my whole point about not making an electability argument is that Joe Biden, for the most part, comes in first. I am making not an electability argument. I'm making an unelectability argument the argument. I'm not making an unelectability argument. I'm suggesting I'm generating unelectability propaganda. I mean,
fair enough. You got to meet people where they are, right? If the majority of people care about electability, it's time to build a case for his unelectability.
I would agree with that.
And Thomas Piketty actually published a pretty interesting paper or some findings last year that the Democratic Party, of course, ignored. And he analyzed a ton of data, from not just from the U.S., but from countries in Europe, saying that actually a centrist candidate is an incredibly risky choice in this day and age.
Yeah, I think framing it in the context of ideology, I mean, is for a Biden supporter is a mistake, because they clearly are not open to that, which is why they've settled on Biden. I think that it's more of like, he's all over the place. He doesn't campaign hard. He's not the guy that people think he is.
He's taking a lot of time off. I mean, one thing you could say about Trump is he certainly loves the campaign. Biden already seems worn out. It's only a couple of weeks in.
I would also say that, honestly, like, to have to reverse yourself on such a major issue so early, you know, like to be forced to do so suggests to me that he doesn't have a good sense of where he fits in politically. And that may be a big liability in the general.
Bhaskar wrote a good piece for The Guardian, but the title was, "If You Care About Beating Trump, Attack Biden," which I think is a good blueprint.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, 6 months ago, the problem with making the electability argument is that you end up creating Biden.
Right. Well, historical conditions change. I wish, yeah.
If you have data, if you have a ton of charts and graphs like the Piketty report does, I mean, I don't know if these people are going to look at them, but at least you have something to offer rather than a hunch.
Yeah, but I don't think that people respond to data. I mean, most people. I just think that, like, you know, it is...
Which is awesome. It's part of our new no data on this show policy.
No, no, we're still going to have data. The people who listen to this show care about ideology. They care about policies for the most part. And they are less likely to be people like, I don't care what Joe Biden stands for. I just think he's definitely going to win. And how you argue with those people is different than how you argue with others, it seems to me.
Sure.
But
that could be your follow-up book, Arguing with Others by Sam Cedar.
That was actually in FUBAR, but I could bring that around. How to something to that effect.
Oh, like how to lose friends and alienate people?
Yes.
Okay, right.
Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Every day, maybe every other day, some days you listen to this show, you wonder, how is it that it just shows up like this? Well, it's because of our members, and you can be one of them for just pennies a day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Today is Monday. Tomorrow will be Tuesday. Michael, what will happen Tuesday night?
Very full show tomorrow night. Bhaskar Sunkara and Ben Burgess are both going to be in studio. We're talking about the ABCs of socialism, the Finland model, the Finnish model. We'll probably talk about some electoral stuff. In the beginning of the show, it'll be a shorter interview, but Glenn Greenwald is going to be on to talk about this Intercept report on the Lula case, which is jaw-dropping. I think probably, I mean, definitely one of the most important stories in the world today.
But no collusion.
God, what? Oh, actually, yes, literal collusion.
Oh, okay.
If there was this type of, well, I don't want to get into that. But anyway, yeah, please. If time permits, we might touch on some other things. I will say that. But it is going to be focused on this story, primarily because this is one of the most important stories happening in the world at this moment, basically validating everything that people like me have been saying in a very disturbing way. All of that tomorrow. I will just make a really brief plug. I'm very proud of the illicit video histories we do, which are for patrons, for Comrade Above patrons, and then they're unlocked. And the first one that is available on our YouTube channel is on the Jesse Jackson campaign and Rainbow Coalition, which goes very nicely with Grimm's interview, as told by Bill Fletcher Jr., who worked on that campaign. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Thanks.
Jamie?
So Ben Burgess did such a good job when Michael had him on the Majority Report that we had him on the Antifada this past weekend. And we talked about all kinds of things. Why the left needs logic and should not cede that territory to twerps like Ben Shapiro, who aren't even good at logic. Why Marx was a super messy bitch who loved drama, but that did not take away from the correctness of any of his arguments. I talk a little bit about my run-in with an Elon Musk fanboy. And we also talked with Ben in a bonus that's going to be out for patrons about the YouTube controversy with Steven Crowder, homophobia, whatnot, and lots of other stuff. So check it out. Also, I cannot recommend enough History is a Weapon, the last two-parter that Sean and Matt did on the 1970s. I think it's a really good companion to a lot of what you talked about today with Ryan Grimm and sort of the overarching political, economic, and social reasons for the neoliberal turn of the 1970s. And it's got consequences that are still with us today. So check it out.
Matt.
The fun and games have begun.
Literary Hangover had its 1 year birthday, actually.
Oh, whoa, congratulations. Last week,
and we zoomed over 200 patrons. Mainly because people really want these this Orweller series I'm doing on the works of the essays of George Orwell, the nonfiction.
Surprise.
And okay, there you go. And I can do one.
It was definitely the way to go.
Yeah, and
have begun.
Yeah,
to eat each other.
Okay, and so yeah, we did Such Were the Joys, which we talked a little bit about how Orwell's dad made his money. He was sort of upper middle class because he worked for the opium trade. And so he got to see that part of Empire. And we talked about Orwell at preparatory school and how he's basically lies about and libels some of his teachers in order to pursue education reform. So he's a good role model.
Here's a quote.
And you, sir, you're a pretender.
I don't even remember where that came
from. Who is that?
I don't remember now.
That sounds like Michael Cohen, sort of.
All right, quick break. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this? Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dennerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on!
Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Hello.
I am a total
pussy. 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 Pussy.